Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to somebody at the National Institutes of Health up in D.C. In particular, his name is Dr. Peter Bandattini, and he is the chief of the section of functional imaging methods at the National Institutes of Mental Health. So, Peter Bandattini, are you there?
Yes.
Welcome to Science Studio.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you.
This should be a lot of fun and I think quite informative. Let's just talk a little bit about Peter Bandattini. How did you get into science in the very first place? What were those early formative years or experiences?
Yeah, so my dad was a high school teacher, but he also was interested in psychology. And so, you know, at the dinner table, he would always be talking about the brain and the mind and things like that. And so right when I was young, I was always exposed to that sort of thing. And fascinated by it. And I was also really interested in basic science, like physics and things like that. And so yeah, all through my grade school and high school, I sort of straddled the two. Like, I was interested in the brain, but also was interested in you know, hard physical science and things like that. So finally in college, I started in engineering, and I thought, no, this is a little bit too just applied right now. Let me just get into physics. And I minored in philosophy, and I took psychology courses, and I was trying to figure out a way of integrating the whole thing. And finally, in graduate school, there was functional imaging that sort of came about. But it didn't really exist when I started graduate school, but I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. And that's another story I could tell a little bit later, but of just being there when functional MRI was taking off. So I was able to then combine the hardcore physics of, like, you know, trying to understand MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, with imaging the brain and actually understanding something about its function.
I want to go back to the dinner table for just a moment.
Yeah.
I mean, if your father and your parents, and did you have siblings too?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So you're all sitting around at dinner, and then your father talks about the brain. Did you play brain games and memory games at dinner?
Not really at dinner, but no. I was always interested in puzzles and things like that, yeah.
Oh, I mean, you weren't quizzed about what was the capital of Ecuador or what was the highest mountain in Botswana and things of this nature.
Yeah, well, not quite that, but yeah. I mean, you know, it would be sort of along those lines. Not really puzzles, but sort of just talking about things like that.
Right. I mean, and that's just such an important part of growing up.
Yeah.
You know, being around the family and questioning each other about what little pieces we know and then where the conversation flows from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, anyway, where did you go to college after you left home? Where's your education?
I grew up in Milwaukee, and I also went to college there at Marquette University. And then I went to the Medical College of Wisconsin, also in Milwaukee. So I kind of stayed in Milwaukee up until I was about 28. So.
Oh, well, that's unusual, in fact.
Yeah.
At least in North America, much more so than, say, in Europe.
Yes. Well, we had good schools there.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's assume you've just arrived at graduate school, all right, and you're a physicist. And what were the big issues in physics outside of what you sort of were looking at yourself?
Well, I mean, I was looking at physics. I mean, I was looking at physics is a wide-ranging area. And definitely early on, like when I was in high school, I'd read Scientific American and see these really funny images of brain function with CT, a computed tomography. It's a form of X-ray that would have tracers. They would look at brain function. I was really intrigued by that. But the physics that was available, it always seemed like it was either like you go into a lab and you do high energy physics or like, you know, studying like superconductors or semiconductors or things like that.
Or string theory, my God.
Or string theory if you wanted to. Yeah, it's hard to find a job and you have to be really good, and there's only a few in academia that would do that. So the more practical thing
there's even fewer that understand it, I think.
Yeah. Exactly. So the practical thing was medical physics, and there it was everything from studying radiation to you know, the other types of imaging techniques, which seemed pretty interesting, and that's kind of what got me into the graduate program. And it's before this kind of revolutionary technique, fMRI, began, but I was still kind of feeling my way towards trying to somehow integrate physics and medical and imaging with understanding the brain at a very deep level.
Okay, but before we go down to fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, let's talk a little bit about magnetic resonance. What is that for the lay person?
So every hospital has them. It's using very, very strong magnets. And essentially when you put your body in these magnets, your protons, they resonate.
That's the hydrogen atoms.
Yeah, the hydrogen atoms resonate at radio frequencies, at exactly about channel 7, or, you know, and so they resonate at that frequency. So you put in an antenna in the scanner as well, and to give you give power to these resonating hydrogen atoms, and then they give off a signal when you blast them with an RF signal, radio frequency signal. They give back off a signal, and then you measure that. And then there's ways of determining where it's coming from in the body, and then you can make these images. You determine where it's coming from by additional gradients that make them process at slightly different frequencies. But the bottom line is that MRI is really the fact that your body has this unique property that the hydrogen atoms resonate at a frequency that's proportional to the field. So these scanners are 30,000 times the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. And so if you go in there, it's a really strong magnet, and suddenly your body becomes this sort of...
broadcaster.
Yeah, broadcaster, exactly. And so that's the basis of how scanners work, and that's how we make images. They've been around since 1984 in hospitals, and they're all over the place.
Now, let's just talk a little bit about the nature of the hydrogen. I mean, there's hydrogen all over the place. All your proteins, all your DNA... all of these have protons, hydrogen atoms. And so are we basically, though, concerned only with those in water?
Yes.
And so water being everywhere, but it has different aspects of its properties, its volume, et cetera, in different locations within the body. Different organs will then respond at a different frequency, et cetera, et cetera. That's the basic principle?
Right. The amount of time it takes the signal to die away once you blast the body with an RF pulse is very much dependent, like you said, on like whether the signal's in gray matter or white matter or in free water or in, you know, different organs of the body. And so that's the basis of our anatomic contrast.
Right, because if all the water was the same, then you'd just look like one big blank
big bucket of
signal.
Water.
Right. No, lovely. Thank goodness we're not, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that process, by the way, that's called relaxation, right? The time it takes to sort of let the signal die away.
Yes.
Right. So... there we have the brain. Now, let's just talk about the brain a little bit. And where is the water in the brain? I mean, I've heard of people having water on the knee and maybe water in the brain, too, which isn't conducive to good thoughts, perhaps. But there's a lot of water in the brain. And let's just talk about that for a little, please.
Yeah, sure. So your body's made up of about 75% water. And the brain definitely has different quantities of water. A large source of water in the brain is the cerebral spinal fluid, which is mostly water that fills your ventricles, these large areas in the brain that are just purely CSF, and around it forms like this layer around the cortex as well. But then the, you know, gray matter and white matter also, you know, if you actually look at them, they're kind of squishy, and they have a lot of water as well within gray matter and white matter. In the cells, there's water. Extracellularly, there's water, and there's constant water exchange as, you know, the cells get, as the lymphatic system goes in and flushes everything out. So there's a lot of water in the brain. It's actually, the brain is one of the best organs for imaging with MRI because it has so much water and it doesn't move, and, you know, you can differentiate very clearly the gray matter, the white matter.
Well, when you say it doesn't move, it just moves slower.
It just moves slower.
I mean, obviously, if you've got exchange in and out of cells and from one region to another, but it's just a slower process than, say, in your veins.
Yes. And so also, right, there's water in the blood vessels as well, yeah.
So when you started then, you were saying that this concept of the functional MRI was just beginning. So now tell us a little bit about what the distinction here is with functional.
Yeah, so initially when I came into graduate school, I was interested in looking at function in some way, any way possible. And then back in 1989, they just had like spectroscopy, which is very good at looking at other molecules that are related to brain metabolism. So you can actually look at the amount of phosphorus or other things that are related to brain metabolism or glucose. But it was good, but it was very, very insensitive. So you had to average for hours, and it was very low resolution as well. So that was
pretty
good.
Somebody's brain had to be in this magnetic field for hours to do this?
Yes, pretty much.
All right.
Much. But then we went on to trying to figure out other ways of looking at brain function. So we were looking at trying to look at the very subtle flow that occurs when you have a brain, when you have a thought, your blood flow increases in that area a little bit. And we're trying to use MRI that make it sensitized to really slow flow to try to see that. And I was trying to do that at the time, and that didn't quite work either, once again, because it wasn't sensitive enough. But then all of a sudden, I was at this meeting in August of 1991 where this professor from Mass General Hospital showed this movie of a brain shown visual stimulation, and the whole visual cortex kind of lit up, and you saw it right away. You saw this movie, visual cortex was stimulated, it lit up by just simply having a subject viewing a checkerboard pattern that's flashing in front of their eyes. And then when it stopped, it went down right away. And
so that's the functional part. It's just that the brain is doing something, or you're thinking something, and then you begin to see patterns that weren't there without the thought process. So that's where the function comes from.
Exactly, exactly. And so Ken Kwong was the researcher there. Luckily, I was working with a colleague of mine, Eric Wong, at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He had just built this very specialized piece of equipment to do high-speed imaging with MRI. It was a grating coil that, if you tried to do high-speed imaging with a standard scanner at the time, it would blow up the amplifiers. It wouldn't work. So we had to have this really small coil that had what was called a low inductance. Essentially, it was great because the best story about this is that this guy used sewer pipe, literally built, had a sewer pipe, found some wire with epoxy, pasted this together, hooked it up to the scanner, and suddenly made, a $2 million scanner go about 2,000 times faster.
That's called Yankee ingenuity, right? That was in Massachusetts.
No, that was actually at the Medical College of Wisconsin with Eric.
All right.
In Massachusetts,
Midwest
they had a system.
Ingenuity.
Yeah. Yeah, so Midwest ingenuity, but yeah, in Massachusetts, they had a system called Advanced NMR that was this prototype system for doing high-speed imaging as well. But there are only about three of these systems in the world. And we had just jury-rigged the system just before this meeting came along. So after the meeting was over, we went back, we tried doing high-speed imaging, and I went to the scanner and we tried to locate where, based on anatomy textbooks, where my motor cortex was. And I basically was tapping my fingers stopped tapping my fingers, and we saw the motor cortex light up like it should. But what the curious thing, though, is that what I was always wondering is that why the signal went up. And so that was one of the first things I had to look into, why the signal went up. But it turns out that it wasn't based on flow. It was based on blood oxygenation. So if the flow goes up, what happens is even though the brain uses a little bit more oxygen, there's this huge overabundance of oxygenation in the blood that rushes into the active area. And it turns out that you can be very sensitive with MRI to this oxygenation change.
So hang on a moment. So the increased amount of oxygen caused the MRI signal to increase.
Yes, and it was the water signal. So so it turns out we were very lucky, and this is why, is that a hemoglobin has this incredibly unique property. And hemoglobin is on red blood cells, and it's involved with delivering oxygen to the body. And so it has this great property of when it's bound to oxygen, it looks like just all the other tissue in the body. It's called diamagnetic. It has similar magnetic properties.
Right.
When it's unbound, after it's delivered oxygen, it's slightly paramagnetic, making it a little bit more magnetized such that it distorts the magnetic field around it. And this actually causes all the hydrogen atoms, once again, to spin a little bit different frequencies. And they all cancel each other out, and the signal goes down around these red blood cells. So you can imagine then in a person's brain that's just at rest, the flow is normal, they're pulling oxygen from the blood, and the overall signal is low. And so once they start becoming active, once the brain becomes active in that specific area, the flow goes up, there's more bound hemoglobin molecules that rush in, and the signal goes up a little bit because there's less cancellation of the hydrogen processing spins.
That's really interesting. So even just a mild thought process requires a significant amount of oxygen somewhere.
Eat up that much oxygen, and actually this is interesting too, is that this is still a mystery. Why does the blood flow increase so much? Because the delivery of oxygen, it's an overabundance of oxygen that comes in. So here's the thing, if it exactly matched the need of the neurons being active, we wouldn't see any signal. It would just exactly match, so the oxygenation would stay the same. But instead, there's this overcompensation. And so it's still an open mystery as to why the blood flow increases so much with brain activation that you can see an oxygenation increase.
That's interesting, and we'll come back to it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm talking to Peter Bandettini, and he's the chief of the Section of Functional Imaging Methods at the National Institute of Mental Health. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. When you hear of tombs in Egypt, they're usually of the pharaohs. But the latest discovery is that of a prestigious physician who served the royal family during the building of the pyramids.
The tomb belonged to Shepseskaf An and dates to 2400 BC. He served the pharaohs of the 5th dynasty in the Old Kingdom when the empire was in decline. Archaeologists discovered the tomb in a vast necropolis just outside of Giza.
Shepseskaf practiced medicine that was rather sophisticated for its day. Part of that was keeping clean to prevent illness and disease. Egyptians bathed often, shaved off all their body hair, and ate a diet that excluded unclean animals.
Egyptians also experimented on and studied the human body, correlated anatomical changes with disease, and developed remedies. Mummification provided excellent opportunities for this.
Discoveries of medical papyruses reveal details of magical spells as well as descriptions of stomach diseases involving intestinal parasites, skin diseases, diseases of the head, flow of urine, traumatic injuries, and the diseases of the extremities.
Then what follows are lists of prescriptions to relieve the symptoms, some of which had been made and used by the gods themselves. Some papyruses list diseases that can't be translated, and others are devoted entirely to obstetrics and gynecology.
Because Egyptians valued knowledge and were avid record keepers, we get a glimpse of a day in the life of an Egyptian doctor. Archaeologists will learn more about Shepseskaf as they excavate his 8-room burial chamber.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Peter Bandettini from the National Institute of Mental Health. And we're talking about what happens when you have an idea. And it turns out that there's a big increase in the flow of blood in your brain. And Peter and his colleagues can measure this by using nuclear magnetic resonance imaging associated with hydrogens. Now, so that's a mystery as to why it happens. But you're lucky because it happens, and therefore you'll be able to map around the brain all sorts of different functions of the body as it relates to their messaging from the brain. That's the basic idea, I guess.
Yes. Yeah.
So what particular issues are you interested in at the moment?
Right now I'm studying, so I'm at National Institute of Mental Health, and so I care very much about using the technique to actually understand how the brain responses are different in populations that have either schizophrenia or other sort of developmental disorders, or even looking at normal ranges of normal populations. So there's about 1995, but more recently it caught on a lot, there's a new twist on using functional MRI. Instead of actually having a subject do a task, instead of actually giving them a stimulation, it turns out that if you look at the resting brain, if the brain, you just put a person in the scanner and say, just lie there, do nothing. It turns out that the fluctuations in the signal over time in regions that are related to each other fluctuate the same way. So they're correlated. And so if we use a certain processing, you know, of the data, we can actually pull out all kinds of functional organization information from just the resting brain. So if you put a person in a scanner, you have them tap their fingers, sure, their motor cortex is going to light up. But if you put a person in the scanner and just have them lie there and do nothing, and if you look at a signal from one motor cortex, it will look like noise, but it's correlated with the other motor cortex. In this way, we can build up all these
connectivities.
These connectivities. So there's a whole push now in fMRI of connectivity mapping brain connectivity. So, in which it might be very useful as far as looking at if you have populations with, for instance, autism, for instance. The brain there's early evidence that the brain is connected differently or has different disconnections in autism than with normal populations. So we can start to map this as well. And so I'm very interested in resting state and understanding resting state and how it changes, because we don't even know what exactly it, once again, this is another mystery of exactly what it does and why is the brain spontaneously active in this way and what purpose does it serve you know, there's all these networks that we're discovering. Like, for instance, the default mode network. There's this one network in the brain that is more active when a subject's just lying there doing nothing. Is it involved with consciousness or daydreaming? So we're just at the very beginning of understanding this. But
Let me interject. I mean, have you clearly one of the analyses you need to do is because you've got to have an enormous big database, right? I mean, all normal, quote-unquote, people don't have the same response. Therefore, there's a sort of a spectrum of responses.
Yes.
And then there's a spectrum of responses for people who may, for example, have autism. And there will be some overlap, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not like it's over here on the left-hand side is all the normal people, and on the right-hand side is all the less than normal people.
Yeah, that'd be great if it, yeah.
Right. But it is not like that. So the analysis is it needs big computers and big algorithms, et cetera, for you to do this analysis at the moment?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So typically in populations, right, there's a whole distribution of the range of a population. So because there's so much overlap with normal populations that you might be able to, if you average them all together, you'll see a difference. But if you look at any individual, you can't say for sure that they're in one population or the other. But we're working in that direction. We're actually getting better with our algorithms. So we have tons of data, and then we're trying to figure out how to more carefully look at it. So if we just look in one dimension, like, okay, let's say connectivity from one area to another, we might not be able to pull apart individuals. But if we look at five different other variables and say, okay, well, they have to have this sort of connectivity, this type of disconnectivity, this type of connectivity or whatever, then you can start to then say, well, if they have all of these, then they might fall into this realm. And so that's the way we're trying to go to sort of use fMRI clinically then, to say it's our ultimate goal to be able to put a person in the scanner and say, hey, you know, you have this type of disorder and this is our treatment that we're going to do with you.
So let's just talk a little bit about the sort of the physical environment of the patient or the target. You talk about the scanner. Now, sometimes when some of these machines started out, there's an enormous big cavity. People disappear into the cavity. Have we got a better way of doing this now such that it's less perhaps intimidating, which might cause people to have errant ideas when they're in the machine, right?
Yeah. Well, not only is it a big cavity. I mean, so we're working on that. I mean, there's companies that are getting larger bore magnets. So instead of being a small hole, it's a big hole, which helps a little bit. But there's still engineering limits to how small we can make that if we still want a strong magnet. But also, it's loud.
I've had a couple. Bang, 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 bang. And then you think it's finished, and bang.
Yeah, exactly. So it's loud. We're working on ways of either dampening that or using different what's called pulse sequences, the way they run the scanner, to make it quieter, to have less sharp edges and how we drive the gradients. So we're trying to make it quieter. Even still, I think the best thing that we can do right now is still, you know, get people conditioned to that environment and by putting them in mock scanners to try to simulate that.
So you just go into the office and sit in a mock scanner for a little, and then the appropriate scanner seems much less intimidating.
Right, and it's especially useful for scanning children,
right,
and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, one of the things I do know a little is that, you know, sometimes there are people who, for example, have pacemakers.
Yeah.
And so it used to be, I think even 5 years ago, that if you had a pacemaker, you really were not a candidate for having an MRI on your brain, for example. But I gather now we are getting to magnets which have much smaller fields but still have the capacity to do good imaging. Am I right in that?
Yeah. I mean, we still have to – I mean, for doing the brain at the fields that we have to use, generally fMRI benefits from higher fields. But still in the clinic, there's, you know, 1.5 Tesla or 3 Tesla scanners that are used typically. And they still have to – you still – can't really have a pacemaker, but there are scanners coming out now that are extremity scanners. So you can have something that just kind of goes around your ankle or your knee or your arm that, you know, are much more focused, much smaller bore, and you can actually image the body that way.
Well, this is a long way from the pacemaker, but I mean, what about for people literally for brains?
Yeah, there are starting to have brain-only scanners. There was a little bit of an effort doing that about 10 years ago, and then it stopped. And now they're revamping that, and they're trying to actually make the fields fall off right near the brain. and so you don't have to worry about pacemakers or things like that. And also, it's much more comfortable. So, but they're not quite there yet. They're still in their sort of design phase as far as doing that is concerned.
You were saying earlier that you've done experiments on yourself. Do you, in fact, have a pretty good idea the way your brain reacts to different thought processes and images?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, no, you experiment on your... It sounds very exciting.
Well, I don't do that. It's funny because actually I haven't really done it recently. In the last, 15 years, I generally don't go in the scanner for my own studies. But when I was a graduate student, I spent thousands of hours in the scanner doing everything. So at 3 in the morning, it would just be me and a technician. I would jump in the scanner. This technician would run the scanner, and I would just do stuff. I'd tap my fingers. I'd look at visual stimulation. I'd hear auditory stuff. So, yeah, I have a good idea. I have a whole bunch of brain activation maps for my brain back then.
Did you do the same thing when you were, say, listening to music or trying to meditate and, different mental states that you could sort of reproduce?
Yeah, so early on, we did that as well. Right. And we found really interesting results there. Like, for instance, just imagining playing the piano. I don't really play the piano, but imagining doing like some sort of complex finger movement without even moving your fingers, we saw a lot of activation, like just in the area of cortex in front of the primary motor cortex and also behind it, but not the motor cortex.
So just similar to actually tapping your finger, but not quite.
Yeah, exactly.
Do I assume that in the future or very soon that each hospital that has these MRI instruments, they're going to have people like yourself to sort of be on call? They're not MDs, perhaps, but they know the algorithms, they know the software, and they're perhaps a little more adept at interpreting data than, say, the medical profession itself.
Yeah. No, once fMRI becomes more clinically useful, once it sort of gets its foothold in the door of being a technique that radiologists go to or neurologists go to or even psychiatrists, then we'll have to have people who are a little bit more expert in doing fMRI and interpreting the data, or even they will become more experts in terms of their medical training, or also technologists themselves. I think that it's ready to go. It's just a matter of finding the key application for this sort of thing that really works, that really is necessary, because it's an expensive technique. And so to justify that, we have to, make it really clinically useful, which is not quite there yet, but I think it will be. And what, like I said, once it will be, there will be people like myself or people that are trained in interpreting the data, because it is a very different data set than your standard MRI data set, which is just an image.
Well, it's been an interesting investigation into an area which I myself know very, very little. But Peter Bandettini from the National Institute of Mental Health in Washington, D.C., thank you for being here on Science Studio.
Oh, thank you.
And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for making all the corrections before you hear the program. And we'd like to thank the audience for being out there, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Last month, Fort Bliss military medical personnel began working alongside staff at University Medical Center. The partnership helps to ensure that military caregiver skills remain sharp during periods of non-deployment. UMC is El Paso's only Level 1 trauma center. William Beaumont Army Medical Center on Fort Bliss is a Level 3. Learn more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from the Sierra Providence Health Network.